Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Louisiana author Tim Gautreau's new novel, The Missing, opens in war-torn France at the end of World War I. It ends in dark swamps and backwoods Arkansas. In between, it churns the Mississippi in a four-deck, 300-foot stern-wheel steamboat. Not in Mark Twain's time, but in the roaring 20s, with jazz, moonshine, a kidnapping, reckoning. This hour on Point, we're going over the river and into the woods, rough, with Louisiana's Tim Gautreau. You can join the conversation. Have you read Gautreau? Do you know this river, these woods, the urge for vengeance? Joining me now from KSLU in Hammond, Louisiana, is novelist and short story writer Tim Gautreau. He's a Louisiana native, grew up the son of a tugboat captain. He's writer-in-residence and professor emeritus at Southeastern Louisiana University in Hammond. His new novel is The Missing. The New York Times calls Gautreau a spinner of yarns with a moral, and The Missing moving and resonant. The Times-Picayune calls The Missing Gautreau's masterpiece. Tim Gautreau, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you. I wish you'd just start off by introducing us to your main character here, Sam Simoneau, and just the salient key facts of his early birth that lead to his uncle finding him in a bit of a bad and tragic situation.
Tom, Sam Simoneau is a person I got out of the police reports in the Times-Picayune. That's how I get the seeds for a lot of my narratives. I read the police reports. I read about a kidnapping in which a child was almost abducted out of a retail center. I began to think, what would that security guard who foiled the kidnapping feel like if he hadn't succeeded? And if for the rest of his life he had to wonder about this child that he was partly responsible for losing. And that went into the heart of Sam Simoneau, the character, as I put him together. He was the guy with this sense of duty. And the whole story grew out of this particular seed. Sam Simoneau, the character, is born and raised in my imagination in southwest Louisiana in the Cajun culture. Grew up speaking French, but he understood that he had a certain amount of musical talent, and he wanted to move off the farm, go to New Orleans when he was about 16, and then he goes off to war. There's a section, the book actually starts in France. He arrives in France on the day that the armistice is signed, and so the people there nickname him Lucky, and he keeps his name throughout the novel. This is his nickname. This is a kind of ironic nickname, of course, as it as the narrative turns out.
He goes off to war just as the war ends, and that's kind of a pattern that occurs again and again here. There's this sort of shocking infancy of Sam Simoneau, where his entire family, it's not clear early in the book but his entire family is slaughtered, and his father pokes him into a cold cast iron stove just before the slaughter begins. He's the only one to survive.
Right. And he has a lot of baggage.
Yeah, I guess.
That follows him through life. The normal archetype in American fiction and American narrative is for some sort of tremendous amount of revenge to occur. And I thought, what would it be like to construct a narrative in which this didn't exactly happen? Because what's important about vengeance is, I was reading the last Sunday's book review in the New York Times, and the lead sentence was, "While violence never fails to provoke and disturb, it's the absence in its wake that continues to affect us." Mm-hmm. And that struck me as being a pretty lucid understanding of one of the key points of the novel, that you're left behind. The people who are left behind are left with this giant hole in their lives whenever someone in their family is killed. And, of course, Sam's entire family is wiped out, and he's raised by a very loving uncle. And that affects the rest of the narrative. When he gets back to New Orleans, he gets a job as a floor walker, which in 1921 is a good job for a farm boy because you're inside, you're not being baked by the sun.
Just kind of a security guard in the department store there.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And I guess floor walkers went out in the 40s, but this scene is set in 1921 and on Canal Street in New Orleans. And a young girl is kidnapped on his watch, and he's sort of blamed for it. He didn't follow the correct procedures for finding a lost child in the big department store, so he's fired. And ostensibly, he goes off to look for this child because his boss tells him, well, if you find the kid, we'll give you your job back. But there are many other motivations, which has to do with his personal history, of course, that makes him go off and look for the child. And the whole novel is this search.
All of that puts him on the river. And, I mean, I think the opening twist for an awful lot of readers is that when you think steamboat and Mississippi and riverboat and river life, Americans almost automatically think Mark Twain in 19th century, but you're in the 1920s here. We should just kind of paint the mural of the Mississippi River life, steamboat life in the 20s compared to the sort of archetypal Mark Twain images that people may have in their minds, Tim.
Right. Well, Mark Twain, of course, was on boats that were actually engaged in interstate commerce. They were hauling freight and passengers. They were building America. They were running where the railroads didn't run. All of that trade played out in the late 1890s, but there were a lot of old big steamboats around that really didn't have much to do. There were some routes that ran as late as the 1930s, but very, very few, and generally on the upper Ohio. But the boats could be bought for a song, and someone got the idea of taking out the entire second deck of cabins, that's where your dining room and all of your passenger staterooms were, and installing a 300-foot-long maple dance floor, and showing up at towns after, of course, the town had been prepped by an advance man putting up all sorts of posters, and hiring the best dance orchestra you could possibly find in the region, and then running moonlight cruises for dancers. And this was a phenomenally successful trade, particularly after the boats that were based in New Orleans would hire local African-American jazz bands because it was an extremely danceable music. And so from really, say, 1910 all the way to 1940, there was this big era in American music history that a lot of people don't know about, where there were these excursion steamers made out of these old packet boats going up and down the Mississippi and the Ohio rivers all the way from New Orleans to Pittsburgh or New Orleans to as close as they could get to Minneapolis, generally Davenport. And they would go from town to town. They would land, and they would run day excursions, generally for church groups or benevolent associations. And then at night was the big dance cruise at 8:30 at night, a moonlight cruise. And they would go out, and there was hot dance music, a waxed-down 300-foot-long dance floor. There were setups for drinks during the Prohibition. The owners of these boats sort of winked at the fact that people brought on a lot of homemade liquor during Prohibition, and some of the boats had a few slot machines sprinkled around when the sheriff wasn't looking.
Just maybe. You know, the way you describe it, moonlight cruises and church groups makes it sound sort of elegant, but there's some pretty rough trade here. This is kind of floating saloon environment at the same time.
It depended on the town. If you landed at a big urban center like Pittsburgh or Cincinnati or New Orleans, you would get civilized crowds. People would dress to the nines, especially for the day excursions, and they would come out and they would use the cruises. The young swains would use them for courting opportunities, etc. But sometimes a boat would tie up at a really rough town, like a mill town or an industrial town or a town that was nothing but chemical factories, and they would entertain those people, and those were different crowds. And sometimes there were big brawls, big fistfights. So the boats always hired several bouncers and made sure that the busboys were big and burly so they could pull apart these brawls.
And all of this, more or less, runs in your blood. Your father, a tugboat captain, but your grandfather was a riverboat captain. Did the stories get passed down?
To a certain extent. I was the youngest child of a youngest child, so my aunts and uncles were very old when I was a child. I was born in 47. My mother was born in 1907. And one of their big entertainments, the fondest memories of youth, was going on the dance boats or the moonlight cruises out of New Orleans or Baton Rouge. And they would dance to Fate Marabelle and the music of Louis Armstrong and all sorts of people who were putting together the jazz idiom in America at the time. And as a child, it was still an old steamboat running in New Orleans. It wasn't a tramping boat that went from town to town, but it stayed anchored in New Orleans. The Old President, which was a big side-wheel steamboat that was originally a packet named the Cincinnati, and she would go out on dance cruises. And my aunts took me along on several of those cruises when I was very young. And I can remember the machinery and how the boat felt and how the whistle sounded and what the officers were like as they ran the thing and what the crowds were sort of like. It was a sort of window into a very early part of American history.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life and death on the Mississippi in a steamboat era you've probably never thought of. Not Mark Twain days, but the 1920s, and a new novel built around a kidnapping and loss. It's The Missing by Tim Gautreau. He joins us from Hammond, Louisiana, and it's getting just rave reviews. You can join the conversation. Are you a Tim Gautreau fan from his earlier work, novels, short stories? And what do you hear in this floating Mississippi world in the roaring 20s? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Tim, I wonder if you'd read a little bit from us. You've got a passage here where sternwheeler, the ambassador, is loading up for a moonlight cruise dance trip early on in the book. Sam's just joined up to work on the riverboat, hoping to find this kidnapped girl. Could you read a bit for us, Tim?
Sure. I'd be glad to. Late in the day, it was still hot. Sam stood on the wharf and directed jostling couples up the steamboat's stage plank to the ticket booth on the main deck. The calliope began gargling, the high notes singing flat until the whistles warmed up. Fred Marble, the pianist with the black orchestra, wearing a slouch hat and gloves against the flying steam, tickled out "Ain't We Got Fun" on the roof, the instruments wincing notes sailing upriver over the French Quarter. Couples in their 20s and 30s began showing up, then what looked like a small men's club, everybody in seersucker and straw boaters. For the most part, people were well-dressed, the young women in thin drop-waist dresses, the men in summer suits. The calliope music stopped with a yodel, and out of the long, curving line of open windows above Sam, the band began to pour a thumping loud rendition of "When My Baby Smiles at Me" in a rattling good dance tempo, the music coming down on the crowd like peppery candy for the ears. Customers began to back up on the broad stage plank, and as departure time drew close, they were stacked three abreast, grinning and craning their necks at the big white apparition. Sam palmed a nickel-plated counter, and when he checked it, it read 1,255. Four deckhands shuffled down to stand by their bits, and the boat's steam whistle let out a deep, river-filling chord. Ralph Brandywine would pilot the ambassador through the city river traffic, and he leaned out the wheelhouse window holding a megaphone and yelled down to Sam to hustle the last customers on board. The paddle wheel began to turn slowly, the half-ton deck bell banged three times, and a crush of customers bunched up on the stage as though afraid of being left behind on the wharf, the worst thing that could happen to anybody, to be left out of the steamy cloud of music and fun. Sam began to enjoy paddling the people on board, calling out for everyone to step up, thumbing his little counter device, getting lost in the excitement and the smell of vanilla, witch hazel, jasmine, dusting powder, and sin. 2 minutes later, the steam capstan sputtered the stage plank aboard, and the mob of latecomers jammed against the ticket booth on the first deck as the boat backed away in earnest, steam spuming from vent pipes in the hull, engine room gongs cracking alive like fight bells, and above it all, big mossy gouts of coal smoke roiling from the stacks. Sam looked back across the wharf and saw 200 yards off three teenage girls running in heels through the falling light, hands on hats, purses flying out from their elbows, the hems on their short dresses shimmying with the white reciprocal blur of their knees. But it was too late, and he didn't want to think about what was in their girl hearts as the big boat turned out under the early stars, an image of romance, hot dance music, or just dumb human fun based on the necessary mystical imagining that things in general just ain't so bad all the time.
Tim Gautreau reading from his new novel, The Missing. Now, your dad was a tugboat captain. I guess that means not on the river, but down what, around New Orleans or on out? Not towboat we're talking here, but tug?
Well, he worked both, but he was mainly a towboat captain. He worked Intercoastal Canal, and very often he was on the Mississippi River, and I would ride with him as sort of an auxiliary wheel man and go up, sometimes we'd go up to Baton Rouge, a little further north.
And your grandfather's riverboat days, were those Mississippi, or...?
He was in the Atchafalaya Basin. He ran lumber steamers, and sometimes he would get out into the big river. Engineers tended to go from job to job in those days. He was chief engineer on steamboats, passenger and freight steamers.
I read that your family came to New Orleans all the way back in 1785 with a group of Acadians. Now, does that make you Cajun, or how does that work exactly?
I guess you could call it that. The Gautreau line goes back to 1785 in New Orleans. We were banished from Nova Scotia and went back to France for 30 years, but the Acadians that went back to France did not assimilate. And the Spanish government needed farmers desperately in 1785, so they bankrolled that batch of Cajuns to come over and set up farmsteads.
I wonder how it feels. You've written short stories for a long time and some very well-received novels, The Next Step in the Dance in 99, The Clearing in 2003. Times-Picayune calls this one, The Missing, your masterpiece. After a lifetime of writing, how does that feel to have it received that way? Do you look at it that way, I wonder?
Well, who knows what's to come. I hope to get better and better.
Right.
Things seem to be getting better, so who knows what's down the line.
And how about...
It took a long time to write The Missing. A lot of work went into it. Maybe it's the most researched book, but a lot of it is personal history, just as in The Clearing, a lot of that was family legend and history.
Let's get a call from Juanita in Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. Juanita, you're on the air with Tim Gautreau.
Hi.
Hi.
I grew up in Louisiana, and I can remember going as a high school group on the president for a dance, and it was very exciting, and the band that was playing for us was Pete Fountain before he became famous.
Sure, and this is the big boat tied up right there in New Orleans, Juanita?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The president.
So, in a way, you're part of the tradition that Tim Gautreau's writing about here.
I absolutely am. In fact, my family owns 4 weekly newspapers in different parts of Louisiana. So I have never read any of his novels, but now hearing this, I'm going to look for the latest one.
That's great. Thanks for calling, Juanita. Tim, were you out there yourself on some of these late midnight moonlight cruises?
Mainly I would take the day trips with my aunts. I was in the 1950s and 60s when I did that. But the president was steam all the way up until 1979 and still exists somewhere. They don't use it anymore, but I think it's tied up in Alton, Illinois.
So what, did they just keep running these steamboats with shoveling the coal in until they fell apart and diesel took over just by the exhaustion of the old boats?
Basically, a lot of the old boats were wooden hulled, and they babied them along. The Capitol, for example, ran all the way, I think, until 1942, 43, and she was ancient by then. She was probably the last of the first-generation boats. Of course, the president was originally the Cincinnati, which was a packet, and she was built in 1924.
I remember what I guess must have been replicas much later, all the way up the river in Hannibal, sort of day trip, you know, steamboats that, mm-hmm. that would take folks around. What about the music? Juanita mentions Pete Fountain, but you've got a lot of music, and music plays an important role in The Missing. It's representing a new kind of music, jazz, which had all kinds of very, very clear racial and sort of edgy tones about it in this time, the 1920s. Tim, give us some of that sense.
Well, Sam Semino is a pianist, and he's a sort of a so-so pianist, and he gets a job on this boat because the little girl that was kidnapped was part of an act. She was 3.5 years old. She was just joining her parents as a little singer. She had a little bell-like voice. She was a very special child.
Her parents are musicians on the boat, yeah.
Yeah, they're musicians on the boat, and white musicians. And he goes along with them because they figured that somebody who saw the little girl's act somewhere on the boat's route was responsible for her kidnapping. That's why he's in this, mm-hmm. this whole milieu.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as the history of jazz music on the riverboat scene, the boats, the Streckfuss line in particular, which was a line of excursion boats, would recruit bands in New Orleans. Legend has it that they went out one day with about 1917 or 18 with two bands on one excursion. They had a really ritzy white orchestra on the main dance deck, and upstairs on the Texas deck, which had some open area, they put an African-American New Orleans jazz band. And by the middle of the cruise, all the dancers were outside in the dark dancing to the African-American band, and almost nobody was dancing to the big fancy orchestra. And right then, it was decided that this is the band that they ought to recruit for the young people. Jazz music, of course, in 1920 was revolutionary. Dixieland was hot music that generated all sorts of new dance steps, and the young people just went wild for it. Louis Armstrong in 1919 or 20 or 21 was like the Rolling Stones in 1966.
Right.
So that's how they looked at it. And the only way you could get jazz music in the early days, if you lived in Davenport or Vicksburg, mm-hmm. or Memphis, was off of an excursion steamer that showed up and could put 2,500 people on board.
But you use it kind of interestingly as a literary catalyst here, because it came with all kinds of racial resonance. It was almost had an edge like we think of hip-hop, I don't know, 20 years ago. That, you know, it mixed things up when jazz came on the scene, especially steaming up there through the heart of old Dixie.
Yeah, it... one of the big worries of the early excursion boats was landing at a rural town, filling the boat up with 2,500 white people, and then presenting the music via an African-American orchestra, because many of these people had never seen an African-American that, with a suit and a tie on before. And, of course, these orchestras are very well-dressed. And so there was always that kind of a worry, how are the people here going to respond to this particular type of music, because it was so revolutionary. But it was also extremely danceable, and that's what ultimately won people over. And it was better music than the white bands could put out in that particular era, particularly, I guess, in 1718.
So we've got
a lot of, you know, naturally jazz began to spread, and
sure.
many orchestras sprang up.
It's about as rich an environment as we can picture when you put that whole gumbo together. The Times and others describe you, Tim Gautreaux, as, the Times says, an old-fashioned storyteller, a spinner of yarns with a moral. How do you feel about that? Do you set out to bring a moral to it? Does it just happen for you
as a
writer?
That type of stuff comes out of an author, no matter what he writes. I could write a letter to my insurance company. It would probably have some sort of a moral fundamental working there.
So tell us about what some of the moral quandaries at work in this book. The issue of vengeance comes up, and comes up very strong, not just from the kidnapping, but from Sam Semino's very, very earliest years, as we heard earlier. And he's there also in a war environment where he sees the havoc, the devastation of the war, left behind by the World War I that he just misses in France. How do you begin to turn over those themes of violence and vengeance and the emptiness that can come along, Tim Gautreaux?
to, without giving the novel away, all I can talk about is, all I can say is something sort of general, but I noticed that the archetype for the template, so to speak, for the way Americans look at any type of injury that that is done to someone or any type of tragedy that happens, that this should be some sort of a recompense, some sort of a vengeance. Americans are very Old Testament when it comes to vengeance. And I didn't want to write a book like that. The book is an exploration of how one-for-one vengeance really is sort of beside the point. And that's mixed up in this business about, you know, many people lose people in this book or briefly mention people who have been, who are missing in their lives. And I guess that's why where the title came from, The Missing. At one point in the novel, a character says, when somebody's killed, you don't lose just that person, but you lose everything he or she can do for an entire lifetime. And so The Missing is about this big vacuum, this big emptiness that's left behind when somebody's lost. That's one of the things it's about.
Mm. There are holes in the lives in this book, and bullet holes in the wall. Tim Gautreaux joins us from Hammond, Louisiana. Let's get a call from Bill in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Tim, it's Bill Dowie here.
Hey. Good to see you.
Just wanted to make the point that when I grew up in New Orleans, too, and went on the president myself, I think I probably went on later than you did, Tim, I loved that dance floor. It was so huge and so smooth. It was the incredible dance floor there on the president. And also wanted to say that a lot of people don't know that Tim Gautreaux is a pretty good dancer. He and his wife, Winborn, do a lot of Cajun two-step and step out all the time. So,
that's true. I'm doing fine. Couldn't be better.
He's doing very well with this new book. Bill, what did you feel like you were part of when you were dancing on the steamboat there tied up in New Orleans? What kind of tradition did it feel like you were part of, Bill?
Well, actually, it goes for me back to when I was in eighth grade in grammar school. My grammar school class had an outing on the president. And so there was always, even as I grew up as an adult, they still continue to have musical ventures, all sorts of different types of music on it, and the last time I remember going on was probably in, Tim said it was still operational as late as 1979, I think it was probably 78, that I remember going on around Mardi Gras time, and they used, at that time, they'd have two or three different groups that would play one after the other, and just a great fun, not only being there, but then going out at nighttime and above board and looking at the stars if you didn't want to continue dancing all the time. It was a great variety. Lots of fun.
Sounds like a great setting for romance. Or if you're at one of the little more rough and tumble locations up the river for some trouble. Bill, thank you very much for calling. Tim, is that right? You and Winborn, your wife, out there cutting up the rug or the wax floor?
Oh, yeah. We took jitterbug classes 40 years ago or so, 30 years ago. And, of course, dancing is very much in Louisiana culture, Southwest Louisiana and in the New Orleans culture.
Let's go out with a little
people
more.
Just like to dance.
Yeah, absolutely. This is from 1924. We'll go out here with Frankie and Johnny from Fate Marabelle. Tim Gautreaux is with us. His new novel is The Missing, set on the Mississippi of the 1920s. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about life and death on the Mississippi in a steamboat era, not Mark Twain's, but the roaring 1920s, in a new novel built around a kidnapping, dealing with loss there. Tim Gautreaux is the author. He joins us today from Hammond, Louisiana. The book is The Missing. Jazz, murder, vengeance, loss, all going on here around the kidnapping of a 3-year-old girl. We've got a call right here from Louisiana, Port Allen, Louisiana, and Ron. Hi, Ron. You're on the air with Tim Gautreaux.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hey. Tim, I just wanted to call and mention to you that I think you're from Morgan City originally.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Married a girl from Morgan City. Married a girl from Morgan City and lived there many years myself. And I came across a collection of your short stories a few years back, and I can't remember. I'm in the car, so I can't go to find it. But had not read fiction in quite a while, and I picked up a collection of your short stories, and the descriptions of the countryside in Southwest Louisiana and the people have stayed with me. You're just a fabulous writer. And I've always
wanted thank you.
To have the chance to tell you that.
Ron, that's great. I appreciate your call. Morgan City is kind of a gritty town. Do you think Tim caught it?
That area?
Well, it isn't anymore, but at one time it was, and there was surely some material for books and short stories down there at the time that I lived there.
Tim Gautreaux?
To say the least.
Yeah, to say the least. That's great. Ron, thank you very much for calling. Let's get another call right here from Buffalo, New York. And Harold. Harold, you're on the air with Tim Gautreaux.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you?
Very,
hi, Tim.
Very well.
How are you?
Como se va, Tim? I taught in Lafayette, Louisiana for 7 years at USL, the university there, and got steeped in Cajun culture and actually taught Cajun culture. Not even though I wasn't a Cajun. I wanted to say two things to you, Mr. Gautreaux. One is I just read your Times book review this morning because I just the first chance I had to actually look at it. I was very happy to see what you had to say, and especially what you said this morning about two things. The missing idea of how when somebody dies in our lives, all the things that they could have done is now no longer there. My uncle died in Normandy in World War II, and I wish that he was there for me when I was growing up. And that every day I wish for that. I've gone to his grave and placed flowers on his grave. I wish he was here. The second thing is that, yeah, vengeance, it's an afterthought. It's something else that happens, and I wanted to give you kudos on that remark. And I look forward to buying your book and reading it. Thank you so much, sir.
Harold.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling, Harold. That vacuum that never goes away from those who are dead, the missing, and also vengeance. We don't need to give the plot away at all, but I wish you'd just share some of your thoughts on vengeance with us, Tim, and why it ends up, in your telling, such a dry hole. What is it about human nature, life, the cosmos, that makes vengeance?
Well, I guess it is kind of a I don't know what the word is, a cosmic concern. I guess it's my original take on vengeance is very superficial. I just got tired of seeing so many bloody TV dramas and so many bloody movies where people are wronged and then they go out and they do the Clint Eastwood thing. They kill a whole bunch of folks.
Rambo.
Right. And this is supposed to give you closure, and this is supposed to do this and do that and have all these beneficial and analgesic effects on your soul. But in truth, I don't see it, and I don't buy it. Even I think Hollywood is turning around on this a little bit. If you saw the latest Clint Eastwood movie, Gran Torino, the opposite happens there, really. I won't give that ending away. Of course, everybody's seen the movie. Mm. But in the end of that movie, we have kind of the reversal of the whole notion of vengeance. There's a shootout, but it's not what you would think. And really, the people, the villains in The Missing, get their comeuppance, but not in the way you normally expect it. In the big bloodbath of a gunfight.
Those have happened in stories and movies and life all over this country. But I wonder what you think as a Southern writer. In some ways, I have a strong association with the South as well. The culture of honor, the culture of arms, the readiness for bloodshed. Do you see the South, the country? I mean, it may change in Clint Eastwood's latest movie, but do you see your region changing when it comes to that kind of cultural instinct, heritage?
No, not really. But, you see, I'm not from the Protestant culture of the Deep South. I'm from really the French Catholic culture.
Mm-hmm.
And Cajuns, as it says in the book somewhere, very often were just too poor to afford a grudge. And they really weren't big on vengeance because the results of vengeance are something that hurt the family. And Acadians have always been very family-oriented. Why perform an act of violence that's going to land you in jail if you have children to support? That is sort of the Acadian take on violence and vengeance.
Life is already tough enough. I read somewhere you were describing one of your dad's first jobs out in the kind of cypress swamp, cutting down cypress trees that were 5 feet through the middle, standing in waist-deep water with snakes and leeches and a cross-cut saw in 95-degree heat. I get, you don't need more trouble if that's your day job.
Right. Of course, a lot of people worked hard like that, mm-hmm. but I think it's a cultural difference. It's a sort of a life view that most South Louisiana Acadians have.
Let's get a call from Sarasota, Florida, and Tonka. Tonka, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I started my college career at Southeastern Louisiana College when it was Southeastern Louisiana College.
Yeah, great.
Also, the president rang such a bell. My mother was a cashier on that boat for many years, and I would ride the day trips. I would ride some night trips and fall asleep on those gliders near the dance floor.
Mm-hmm.
Remember those?
Mm-hmm.
Those were pretty cool. My father and my husband are both riverboat engineers. I was thinking about this so-called 6 degrees of separation. I think there's much less. And I'm so looking forward to your book. It sounds exciting.
That's great.
Well, thank you.
Tonka, riverboat engineers, the actual machinery of the river is something you are clearly kind of in love with, Mr. Gautreau. maybe your folks as well, Tonka. But, Tim, this machinery, something about machinery just grabs you as a writer, it seems to me.
Well, I'm interested in obsolete machinery. It's a genetic defect, I guess, but maybe it's a carryover from what my grandfather was interested in. But yes, I have a big collection of steam whistles and steam gauges, and I'm a fireman at the Tennessee Valley Railroad Museum, and I'm always. My wife says the only reason I write fiction is so I can tell people about obsolete machinery.
We love reading about it. It sure brings this to life. There's another point. We keep getting steamboat calls, and why not? The allure is pretty strong.
Yeah, it's amazing that we've gotten several calls on the old president, but then I'm sitting here realizing that she was an excursion boat from 1934 until even after she was dieselized in maybe 1990.
Okay, so she...
millions and millions of people have been on the old president.
I wish you'd read just a little bit more for us from The Missing. We've got a reading later in the book where there's a brawl on the riverboat, where this is not one of the fancier, more elegant cruises. This one turns pretty rough on the ambassadors, pulled into a rough town, and, you know, the boat crew had trouble with those brawls. And you've got a fight scene here that takes place after they've loaded up in a factory town you call Bung City, and they've headed out for a Mississippi cruise. Could you read a bit for us, Mr. Gautreau?
Sure. Sure. Sam Semino's job on this boat is a misery. He works 16 hours a day. He's a bouncer. He gets beat up on every cruise. They run 3-4 cruises a day every day. And so this is a tough, tough job. This is where they land, I think, in a little town in Arkansas, which is a factory town. Mm. Totally made up, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He walked across the dance floor and saw two groups of men pointing fingers and complaining loudly that the band didn't know how to play any reels. Zach Simpson studied his abusers and tentatively began to strum Under the Double Eagle. The band fell in behind him, and nearly 150 couples started to dance 300 different ways. The water tank factory workers, mostly in hobnail brogans, tried to form two lines for a clomping Virginia reel, while the creosote workers, mainly in pressed overalls, were dancing diluted bucking wings, clog steps, or lunging polka stomps deadly to their partners' toes. Pinwheeling dancers broke through the Virginia reel lines like crazed mules spinning out of a flaming barn. By the middle of the tune, half the dancers were capsized on the floor, and a general stomp and gouge had broken out. Charlie Duggs, Sam, and Aaron waded in and began pulling scuffed and screaming women out of the fray. Then they began shoving apart the fighters and getting knocked around for their trouble. The biggest waiters waded in next, pulling hair and kicking, and the orchestra kept playing as if trying to remind everyone what they were there for. A little man pulled a knife, and Charlie slapjacked him on the top of his head. Someone knocked down a tin lantern, and a big fellow fell on it, crushing open the fuel tank, and women shrieked as he caught fire, then leapt up and ran, a flaming cross flying down the middle of the dance floor. Men stopped fighting to knock him over, everyone suddenly mad to get at him, a flurry of sympathetic hands rolling him like a barrel across the dance floor as he hollered and cursed. A man in overalls dumped a pitcher of water over his length, and suddenly the battle was finished. People from all sides grabbed the smoking man's singed hands in congratulation and hauled him to a chair. Most of his hair was gone and his face was blacked, but a woman came down from the cafe and gave him a stick of butter. And when a water tank worker handed him a full glass of whiskey, the victim gave the room a bald-faced grin. Couples reformed. A few started to dance again, and there was a general search for hats and eyeglasses.
Tim Gautreaux reading from a raucous moment there in his Mississippi Riverboat mystery tale, The Missing, just out in quite a book, set in the roaring 20s with life on the Mississippi. Before it's all over, your protagonist, Sam Seminole, is off the river and into the sort of deep woods of Arkansas, back in the swamps of Louisiana. I wish you could give us a sense of what the cultural boundary between those two zones. When you get off the river, when he heads into Arkansas, what's he passing from and to?
Well, he's going off of a mildly civilized milieu of the boat, which is its own floating little civilization, and he's going into the deep south of the early 1920s. Some people imagine that America was totally civilized and structured by that time. They think of the cities. They think of St. Louis or Boston or Atlanta, places that were paved and all connected up with telephones. But the rural areas were not like that at all. In, say, 1921, rural Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi was very much like it was in the 1870s. And with isolation, if you've ever read Heart of Darkness, comes a certain amount of degeneration.
And a kind of clan rule, as you depicted.
Law enforcement in the rural areas was spotty at best. In some places, you had to write a letter if you wanted a lawman to show up. And this is the milieu that he goes into. And a man controlled his own destiny when he was trying to, look for somebody that was to be dealt with back in the woods.
It's compelling terrain, and you bring it over compellingly. I wonder, Walker Percy once said famously that you, as a Southern writer, you've got to be careful that you don't think too much of yourself as a Southern writer or make that the frame of your work, or you will end up, he said, in the business of amazing Yankees, sort of telling stories that will make Yankee jaws drop.
That's one of my favorite Percy quotes.
That's just fantastic. It feels to me, while you're bringing on all this color and all this culture, I don't see you quite dropping yourself in that pigeonhole, Tim Gautreaux.
You have to look at your region's history. Of course, I've lived here all my life, 61 years. You have to develop an ear for the false step, the mistake. When you go over the top, you have to see that. You've got to revise it out of your manuscript. And I think it's really bad to consider yourself a certain type of writer. People ask me all the time, are you a Southern writer? And I say, no, I'm a writer who happens to have been born in the South. And whatever territory you have, that's what you make use of as a writer. But if you actually consider yourself on the grits and gravy train, what's going to happen is you're going to come across as a big cliche monger, and you're just going to pack your prose with all sorts of overused stuff.
You've taught a lot of students, no small number of them, Southern young men and women in your time. You see a different sensibility coming up in the 20-somethings following you into that literary realm, Tim?
Not really. What you have to do is just get the student to understand what his territory is, whether it's a subdivision in New Orleans or Atlanta, that's his territory, or if it's a farm in Minnesota or whatever, that's his territory. Because students don't believe, they don't think territorially anymore. They think we're all part of one civilization, that people in Utah think exactly the same way as people in Biloxi, Mississippi. And, you know, if you've got a head shop and a record store in a community, then it's totally integrated with pop culture. And that nothing is farther from the truth.
When you push them in that direction, are they willing to go there, turn around, and really think about the gritty reality of the place, the space they're from?
No creative writing student is ever worth a damn until he's middle-aged.
So maybe it doesn't matter. But when they get there, they'll be lucky if they had you back in the day.
Right, you have to plant the seeds.
Yeah. It's great. Tim Gautreaux, it's a wonderful tale and a wonderful novel. We're grateful to you for taking your time out of Hammond, Louisiana, and KSLU to join us today. Mr. Gautreaux, author of The Missing, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
We'll go out with New Orleans Shout, 1929, King Oliver. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.